I gave you a marvelous introduction here. I built you up as a virtuoso. This is really very embarrassing, Dell.
Pardon me, Mr. Keating, for playing away off key. I've sounded sour for over an hour, but don't put the blame on me. Cause there's a fly on the music, looks just like a note. He's in my way and I can't play the song the fella wrote. Oh, SWAT boys, SWAT boys, SWAT, SWAT boys. Swatting, boys, swat. There's a fly on the music, got me playing flat. He moves around and makes me sound like Mrs. Murderby's cat. Oh, shoe fly. Shoe, 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 shoe fly. Shoe fly. Oh, shoe fly, shoe. Buzz, buzz, here he is. Buzz, 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 there he is. Here he is, there he is. Now I don't know where he is. There he goes from my music. What a break for me. But start to smack, he's coming back with his whole darn family. Oh, SWAT boys. Oh, swatting boys, SWAT. SWAT boys. Oh, SWAT boys, SWAT. Shoe fly, there he is. Buzz, 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 there he is. Here he is, there he is. Now I don't know where he is. There he goes from my music. What a break for me. But start to smack, he's coming back with his whole darn family. Oh, SWAT boys. Oh, SWATy boys, SWAT. SWAT boys. Oh, SWAT boys, SWAT.
I'm at Theater Radio Theater, an imaginary land where your mind is in charge. Today's story is from D.H. Lawrence and is called The Fly in the Ointment. It comes with a side of Spike Jonze, The Rolling Stones, Wire, and The Cramps.
The Fly in the Ointment. Muriel had sent me some mauve primroses, slightly weather-beaten, and some honeysuckle twine threaded with grey-green rosettes, and some timid hazel catkins. They had arrived in a forlorn little cardboard box just as I was rushing off to school. "Stick 'em in water," I said to Mrs. Williams, and I left the house. But those mauve primroses had set my tone for the day. I was dreamy and reluctant. School and the sounds of the boys were unreal, unsubstantial. Beyond these were the realities of my poor winter-trodden primroses and the pale hazel catkins that Muriel had sent me. Altogether, the boys must have thought me a vacant fool. I regarded them as a punishment upon me. I rejoiced exceedingly when night came, with the evening star, and the sky flushed dark blue, purple, over the golden pomegranates of the lamps. I was as glad as if I'd been hurrying home to Muriel, as if she would open the door to me, would keep me a little while in the fire glow, with the splendid purple of the evening against the window, before she laughed and drew up her head proudly and flashed on the light over the teacups. But Eleanor, the girl, opened the door to me, and I poured out my tea in solitary state. Mrs. Williams had set out my winter posy for me on the table, and I thought of all the beautiful things we had done, Muriel and I, at home in the Midlands, of all the beautiful ways she'd looked at me, of all the beautiful things I'd said to her, or had meant to say. I went on imagining beautiful things to say to her, looking at me with her wonderful eyes from among the fir boughs in the wood. Meanwhile, I talked to my landlady about the neighbours. Although I had much work to do, and although I laboured away at it, in the end, there was nothing done. Then I felt very miserable, and sat still and sulked. At 11:15, I said to myself, "This will never do," and I took up my pen and wrote a letter to Muriel. It was not fair to send me those robins. We called the purple primroses robins for no reason, unless that they bloomed in winter. They have bewitched me. Their wicked, bleared little pinkish eyes follow me about, and I have to think of you and home instead of doing what I've got to do. All the time while I was teaching, I had a grasshopper chirruping away in my head as if it were midsummer there, and the arithmetic rattled like the carts on the street. Poor lads, I read their miserable pieces of composition on pancakes over and over and never saw them, thinking the primrose flowers now because it is so sheltered under the plum trees, those old trees with gummy bark. You like biting through a piece of hard, bright gum, if your lips did not get so sticky. I will not say at what time I finished my letter. I can recall a sensation of being dim, oblivious of everything, smiling to myself as I sealed the envelope, of putting my books and papers in their places without the least knowledge of so doing, keeping the atmosphere of Strelley Mill close round me in my London lodging. I cannot remember turning off the electric light. The next thing of which I am conscious is pushing at the kitchen door. The kitchen is at the back of the house. Outside in the dark was a little yard and a hand's breadth of garden backed up by the railway embankment. I had come down the passage from my room in the front of the house and stood pushing at the kitchen door to get a glass for some water. Evidently, the oilcloth had turned up a little and the edge of the door was under it. I woke up irritably, swore a little, pushed harder, and heard the oilcloth rip. Then I bent and put my hand through the small space to flatten the oilcloth. The kitchen was in darkness, save for the red embers lying low in the stove. I started, but rather from sleeping wonder than anything else. The shock was not quite enough to bring me to. Pressing himself flat into the corner between the stove and the wall was a fellow. I wondered and was disturbed. The greater part of me was away in the Midlands still, so I stood looking and blinking. "Why?" I said helplessly. I think this very mildness must have terrified him. Immediately he shrunk together and began to dodge about between the table and the stove, whining, snarling, with an incredibly mongrel sound.
"Don't you touch me! Don't you come grabbing me! I'll hit you between the eyes with this poker! I ain't done nothing to you! Don't you touch me, you bloody coward!"
All the time he was writhing about in this space in which I had him trapped, between table and stove. I was much too dazed to do anything but stare. Then my blood seemed to change its quality. I came awake, sick and sharp with pain. It was such a display as I had seen before in school, and I felt again the old misery of helplessness and disgust. He dared not, I knew, strike, unless by trying to get hold of him I terrified him to the momentary madness of such a slum rat. "Stop your row," I said, standing still and leaving him his room. "Shut your miserable row! Do you want to waken the children?"
"Oh, but don't you touch him! Don't you come no nearer!"
He had stopped writhing about and was crouching at the defensive. The little frenzy, too, had gone out of his voice. "Put the poker down, you fool!" I pointed to the corner of the stove where the poker used to stand. I supplied him with the definite idea of placing the poker in the corner, and, in his crazy, witless state, he could not reject it. He did as I told him, but indefinitely, as if the action were second-hand. The poker, loosely dropped into the corner, slipped to the ground with a clatter. I looked from it to him, feeling him like a burden upon me, and in some way I was afraid of him, for my heart began to beat heavily. His own indefinite clumsiness and the jangle of the poker on the hearth, and then my sudden spiritual collapse, unnerved him still more. He crouched there abjectly. I took a box of matches from the mantelpiece and lit the gas at the pendant that hung in the middle of the little bare room. Then I saw that he was a youth of 19 or so, narrow at the temples, with thin, pinched-looking brows. He was not ugly, nor did he look ill-fed, but he evidently came of a low breed. His hair had been cut close to his skull, leaving a tussocky fringe over his forehead to provide him with a topping and to show that it was no prison crop which had bared him.
"I wasn't doing no harm,"
he whined resentfully, with still an attempt at a threat in his tones.
"I haven't done nothing to you. You leave me alone. What harm have I done?"
"Be quiet," I said.
"You'll wake the children and the people."
I went to the door and listened. No one was disturbed. Then I closed the door and pulled down the wide-opened window, which was letting in the cold night air. As I did so, I shivered, noting how ugly and shapeless the mangle looked in the yard, with the moonlight on its frosty cover. The fellow was standing abjectly in the same place. He had evidently been rickety as a child. I sat down in the rocking chair.
"What did you come in here for?"
I asked, almost pleading.
"Well," he retorted insolently, "and won't you go somewhere if you hadn't a place to go of a night like this?"
"Look here," I said coldly, a flash of hate in my blood. "None of your chelp."
"Well, I only come in for a warm," he said,
afraid not to appear defiant. No, you didn't, I replied. You came to take something. What did you want from here? I looked round the kitchen unhappily. He looked back at me uneasily, then at his dirty hands, then at me again. He had brown eyes in which low cunning floated like oil on the top of much misery.
I might have took some boots, he said with a little vaunt.
My heart sank. I hoped he would say food. And I was responsible for him. I hated him.
You want your neck breaking, I said. We can hardly afford boots as it is. I ain't never done it before. This is the first time. You miserable swine, I said.
He looked at me with a flash of rat fury.
Where do you live? I asked. Exeter Road. And you don't do any work?
Well, I could never get a job, except I used to deliver laundry.
And they turned you off for thieving.
He shifted and stirred uneasily in his chair. As he was so manifestly uncomfortable, I did not press him.
Who do you live with?
I live at home.
What does your father do?
But he sat stubborn and would not answer. I thought of the gangs of youths who stood at the corners of the mean streets near the school, there all day long, month after month, fooling with the laundry girls and insulting passers-by.
But, I said, what are you going to do?
He hung his head again and fidgeted in his chair.
Evidently, what little thought he gave to the subject made him uncomfortable.
He could not answer.
Get a laundry girl to marry you and live on her, I asked sarcastically.
He smiled sicklily, evidently even a little bit flattered. What was the good of talking to him?
And loaf at the street corners till you go rotten, I said.
He looked up at me sullenly.
Well, I can't get a job,
he replied with insolence. He was not hopeless, but like a man born without expectations, apathetic, looking to be provided for, sullenly allowing everything.
No, I said. If a man is worthy of his hire, the hire is worthy of a man, and I'm damned if you are a man.
He grinned at me with sly insolence.
And would any woman have you? I asked.
Then he grinned slyly to himself, ducking his head to hide the joke. And I thought of the coloured primroses and of Muriel's beautiful, pensive face, then of him with his dirty clothes and his nasty skin. Then that given a woman, he would be a father.
Well, I said, it's a knockout.
He gave me a narrow, sleering look.
You don't know everything, he said in contempt.
I sat and wondered, and I knew I could not understand him, that I had no fellow feeling with him. He was something beyond me.
Well, I said helplessly, you'd better go.
I rose, feeling he had beaten me. He could affect and alter me. I could not affect nor alter him. He shambled off down the path. I watched him skulk under the lampposts, afraid of the police. Then I shut the door. In the silence of the sleeping house, I stood quite still for some minutes up against the unpassable fact of this man, beyond which I could not get. I could not accept him. I simply hated him. Then I climbed the stairs. It was like a nightmare. I thought he was a blot, like a blot fallen on my mind, something black and heavy out of which I could not extricate myself. As I hung up my coat, I felt Muriel's fat letter in my pocket. It made me a trifle sick. No, I said, with a flush of rage against her perfect, serene purity. I don't want to think of her. And I wound my watch up, sullenly, feeling alone and wretched.
I please that you accept the next dose of disease. I am the fly, I am the fly, I am the fly, I am the fly, flying the ointment.
Six eyes, I got a garbage brain that's driving me insane. And I don't like the ride, so push that bastard aside. And baby, I won't care, cause baby, I don't scare. Cause I'm a reborn maggot using gym warfare. Rock.
Support comes from support for
United Airlines. United provides
support for NPR
in cities like Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C.
Underwriting today is provided
United
by
Airlines,
Borders, Books and Music,
Jutus, Juice Bar Blend, and by Whitney Farms, producers of a complete line of
public
radio.com.
United provides just another way. National Business Radio is rising. National Public Radio.
National
Business Radio
comes from
United Airlines,
Borders, Books and Music,
Jutus, Juice Bar Blend.
United provides just another way. National Business Radio is rising.
Public Radio.
National Public Radio. Nonstop Business
Radio.
.com.
Public
Radio. Nonstop Business.
Underwriting today is provided by Inktomi. That's Inktomi Scaling.
National Public Radio.
INKTOMI.com.
National Public Radio.
National Public Radio.
Non-stop business.
Radio.com.
National Public Radio. Non-stop business.
Should be tips. Soil amendments and mulches.com.
National Public Radio. National Public Radio. Non-stop business.
Public Radio. Well, lots of pretty good news there. Thanks, Joe. That report brought to you by
National Business Radio.com.